chair of the Federalist Society's International and National Security Law and Policy Practice Group, and it is a privilege to welcome you all today to our panel, where we'll be focusing on whether the U.S. should be engaging, disengaging with international institutions such as the International Criminal Court and the International Court of Justice. It is my honor to introduce today's moderator, but before I do so, the International National Security Law Practice Group does programming like this throughout the year. It takes the form of podcasts, live events, and we cover, as the name of the group suggests, a wide range of issues as it relates to international law, policy, and national security topics. If you have an interest in these kinds of topics, and you want to get more involved, come see me after this panel. Or send an email to me. You can write to MatthewHyman@yahoo.com, and yes, that address suggests how old I am. You're also welcome to reach out to Caroline, who's in this room with the Federalist Society, or Nate Kaczmarek, and any of those people can help you get plugged into the work the group is doing. So thanks again for being here. Our moderator today is Judge Stefanos Bibas. He's a judge on the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Third Circuit. Prior to being appointed to the bench in 2017, he was a professor of law and criminology at the University of Pennsylvania. Earlier in his career, he was an assistant U.S. attorney in the Southern District of New York. He was a litigation associate with the law firm of Covington and Burling, and he was also a judicial clerk for both Patrick Higginbotham with the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Fifth Circuit, as well as Justice Anthony Kennedy with the Supreme Court. And with that, I will turn the panel over to Judge Bibas.
Thank you. Thank you for that kind introduction, Matt. Thank you for the practice group for hosting this. So we're here to talk about the ICJ and the ICC. In the last couple of years, international conflicts put institutions like the International Criminal Court and the International Court of Justice in the spotlight. While Russia's invasion of Ukraine goes on, the ICJ adjudicates a claim by Ukraine against Russia, and the ICC has issued a warrant for Vladimir Putin's arrest. After the October 7th attack, the CJ adjudicated a case that South Africa brought against Israel, alleging a genocide in Palestine. And the ICC is now considering issuing a warrant to arrest Benjamin Netanyahu. Now, historically, these tribunals were criticized either as ineffective at constraining major powers or as politicized. Those theoretical debates are now thrust in the center stage. The role of international law and international courts is being hammered out as we watch it in real time. And the underlying question is crucial. What's the best way to resolve disputes between and among nations? And we have a very distinguished panel to address these and related questions. We're going to go in this order that I introduced them. First, to my immediate right, is the Honorable Charles Brower. Judge Brower is an international judge. He also serves as an arbitrator affiliated with a barrister's chambers in London. He served as a judge in the Iran-U.S. Claims Tribunal since the 1980s. He's also periodically served as a judge on other courts like the ICJ, which he'll talk about today. After him, we'll have Professor Michael Newton, who is a professor of the practice of law at Vanderbilt University. He served as counsel in the ICC, as a senior advisor in the State Department, and in the U.S. Army, both as an armor officer and then as a judge advocate. His research focuses on terrorism, accountability, and conduct during hostile conduct. Next, we have Professor Diane Desierto, who's the Professor of Law and Global Affairs at Notre Dame Law School. She serves on countless commissions of experts on international law and actively practices as counsel at the Permanent Court of Arbitration, the UN Human Rights Committee, and other tribunals. Her research focuses on international law and human rights, international economic law, and international arbitration. And last, but certainly not least, is Professor Richard Epstein, the Lawrence A. Tisch Professor of Law at NYU Law School. He's written persuasively about a dazzling array of interdisciplinary subjects, from Roman law to labor law to financial regulation. I first got to know him when I was a law student more than 30 years ago, when he appeared at a symposium talking about the informal economy and trade in elephant tusks. Unsurprisingly, he's also turned his eye towards international law along the way and brings that perspective to the panel today. So we're going to try to keep introductory remarks in the vicinity of 8 minutes or 7 to 10 minutes. We'll have some more back and forth across the panel, and at that point, we'll open it up for questions. There are two mics on either side, and I'll call on some people so we have time to discuss with the floor. Without further ado, Judge Brower.
Good afternoon. Can everyone hear me fine? Okay. I should begin by making it clear that I am, among other things, the most appointed American as judge ad hoc of the International Court of Justice, of the only 5 Americans who ever have been so appointed. I was appointed twice by the previous Trump administration and once by the Republic of Colombia, serving on the court from 2014 until I resigned in 2022. Previously, I myself had argued cases successfully for the United States and for Costa Rica before that court. And parenthetically, so we got the whole picture, I have served as a judge of the Iran-United States Claims Tribunal, as was said, since 1983, having been appointed first by the Reagan administration and then by the outgoing Clinton administration. And I'm still a member of the court. I believe that it is in the national and international interest of the United States of America, as I hope it continues being the world's leading power, to participate in its own interest in international organizations, including the ICJ and the International Criminal Court. Why should the United States be fearful of the judgments or advice, for example, of the ICJ? Now, recently, on July 19, just passed, in an advisory opinion, which is not legally binding, but nonetheless can be very important, the ICJ ruled by a substantial majority that Israel, since the end of its 1967 survival of the attack by a combination of Arab states, has been in gross violation of 2 Geneva Conventions and a long series of confirming United Nations Security Council resolutions. So now for 57 years, it has unlawfully moved increasing numbers of Israelis into occupied Palestinian territory as settlers, making it harder and harder and harder to ever get a 2-state resolution or get peace truly in the area. A later friend of mine, a Jewish Holocaust survivor from Poland by the name of Theodor Maron, with law degrees already at that time from Harvard and Cambridge universities, in 1967 was the legal advisor of the Foreign Ministry of Israel. And when asked by the government at that time if it could lawfully start making these Israeli settlements in what is legally occupied territory, he advised the Israeli government that if it did so, it would violate well-settled international law. The government nonetheless went ahead. And Ted Maron left Israel, became a famous professor at the New York University School of Law, an American citizen, and eventually the president of the United Nations Security Council's sub-organ, the International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia, which I think was well supported by the United States. Now, why is it wrong? I know other people will differ, but why is it wrong to have held Israel for so long and so seriously, having violated what is hornbook law in international law and has been since the 1920s? In 1984, Unfortunately, the United States was sued at the ICJ by Nicaragua for what it had done to support the Contras, which of course became the Iran-Contra scandal, which took me off the tribunal for a while to the White House as deputy special counselor to President Reagan to help save him from losing the rest of his second term. We were successful, but mostly because he had the right idea, which is, I don't know, everybody, you can have all the records, and he got through it. The complaint of what the United States did, the United States had violated its own law in sending that aid to the Contras, as was ultimately better understood. But the United States, and this is a black mark on its record, frankly, when it was dealing with Nicaragua to court, and it lost its objections to jurisdiction, it walked away. It said, we're not participating anymore. It's like China, much more recently, never participated in the merits of the arbitration that rejected its claims to rights in the South China Sea, and they are violating international law progressively and more militarily violating international law. And what else the United States did at the time, which in my view was really wrong, was to withdraw its acceptance of the compulsory jurisdiction of the ICJ in all cases, which had been approved by the Senate shortly after the end of the Second World War. I think in our present circumstances, it's unlikely that we will ever get that back. But this is not what should happen. And when Nicaragua won the case on the merits and asked the United Nations Security Council to enforce it, which is possible, guess who vetoed that? Now let's turn to the International Criminal Court. Again, I believe the United States should have joined as a state party to the Rome Statute, which established it. Why didn't we? Why not? Because my former Harvard professor, Henry Kissinger, was afraid of being arrested, which I think is generally known, that he was concerned about that. Two former and beloved clients of mine, when I've been in practice, have been wise chairmen of the Governing Assembly of States Parties to the Rome Statute. One was former, which basically governs the whole thing at the top. One was Foreign Minister of Costa Rica, Bruno Staño, and the other you would more likely have heard of was Prince Zayd al-Rad of Jordan, of the royal family, who later served a term as the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights. That court, at the beginning, was attacked by African states because most of the people investigated and brought before the court were really bad people causing lots of trouble in very difficult circumstances in African states. But who can differ with its issuance of an arrest warrant for Vladimir Putin? I think that's hard. And given what has been going on in Gaza, and I will say even before the 7th of October 2023, frankly, who can blame the ICC's prosecutor for recommending that an arrest warrant should be issued for Bibi Netanyahu, which recommendation, as was mentioned, has already been long considered by the court's body that must approve it, and so far there's no result of that. My final point is the United States Senate notoriously has failed to give its advice and consent to ratification of very important treaties, such as the Law of the Sea Convention, which forces the Pentagon to say, okay, we're not a party, but we accept it as customary, as reflecting customary international law, as has said the International Court of Justice and the Iran-United States Claims Tribunal. The other one was a Vienna Convention on the Law of Treaties, which you might think is a very academic thing, but it's extremely important in all the thousands of arbitrations that we have, investor-state cases in particular. This is a treaty that tells you how to interpret treaties. And it was adopted, went into force on 27th of February, 1980, and could hardly have been controversial. Well, you fight the good fight, you keep fighting it. And I think the United States' interest is to keep fighting the good fight in all of these organizations. Thank you very much for your attention.
Mr. Brower. Thank you, Judge.
Well, that's actually a quite beautiful segue. It's a distinct joy and an honor to follow such a distinguished jurist, and this is a great panel, and we really appreciate you all being here. My day started at 3 a.m., so if I talk fast and sound Southern, sorry. I want to pick up on that theme, and we hadn't planned that, but that's exactly the theme of my 10-minute talk as I set my timer, and I'll finish early, is this concept of fighting the good fight. With the slight derivation that in many of these instances, I come at this as an insider and as a litigator, helped negotiate the Rome Statute, negotiated the elements of crimes, and I guarantee you, as a matter of rock-solid American military interests, we join consensus on those elements because they're right on the law. Absolutely rock-solid. We have to, and to use the military metaphor, stand on the bulwarks to ensure that they continue to apply that law correctly in a way that doesn't undermine U.S. military operations all around the world every day. So my theory is one of critical engagement. We have to be very clear-eyed when to engage and how to engage in these institutions, but also be very rational and calculated in the connection between what's going on in the courts, and I'll give you a number of substantive examples. Okay, great, an advisory opinion, right, not legally binding, who cares, going to be ignored, and any rock rib, know-nothing will tell you, we don't care about those things because they're not enforceable. Let me give you two examples why we do care. Mauritius, in the early days when they set up the British Indian Ocean Territory, the Brits ended their colony, they gave Mauritius their independence, and of course we carved out Diego Garcia as part of the British Indian Ocean Territory. They tried and failed to get a compulsory jurisdiction case. They then got a General Assembly resolution, which resulted in a strikingly solid and unanimous, very well written actually, advisory opinion. And the rock rib know-nothing would say, who cares? Just some stupid court sitting in The Hague. Well, you take that ruling, unenforceable, nobody cares, and then you apply that in the law of the sea, which is binding and enforceable, and all of a sudden the Brits are at the table negotiating, and I will tell you this, it's not public knowledge yet. Well, it's public knowledge, but the details aren't yet. We've spent the last 2 years negotiating with the Brits on a long-term deal that settles full sovereignty for Mauritius, returning the Chagos Islands, and in our case, Diego Garcia. You think there's some American interest involved there? None of which would have happened without that first advisory opinion or the law and the policy behind that. So here's the way I think about it. Oh, and the South Africa Tribunal. I wasn't going to mention this, but I will. South Africa, the Chinese have said they're going to ignore it. If you follow this very closely, and I could give you the indicia of this, they have in fact changed their behavior on the margins. But the way I think of that judgment is not about enforceability and what's the law and who's going to arrest Xi Jinping. I think about it as a centripetal force that holds our Indo-Pacific strategy together. Do we care about the Koreans, the Japanese, the Indonesians, the Vietnamese? You better believe we do. And that judgment is the centripetal force that binds us to allies in achieving U.S. national interests. And if we had let that case come out the wrong way, you can see the corollary, it would have set back our relations. So there's a general framing, conscious of time, I'm spot on. To fall back in my training from West Point, I want to tell you how these tribunals shape the battlefield. They do it both metaphorically and literally. I've already given you a couple of specific examples, but here's the metaphorical shaping. In the Gambia v. Myanmar case, there's been, in my business, a long line of these cases, some of which I've litigated, some of which I've investigated on the ground. And for those international law scholars here, you're all familiar with this concept of fragmentation, that international law is all over the map. Which single body in the world today is responsible for human rights? I could give you a very confusing Venn diagram of all the people that claim that. Genocide law is exactly the same way. It's very fragmented, ranging from all of our work at the ICTY in Yugoslavia to the negotiation of the Rome Statute, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But a critical element of the development of genocide law, which, of course, those who are following Gaza absolutely care about, comes through the strand of ICJ jurisprudence, whether it's Bosnia, Croatia, and a line of other cases. Gambia v. Myanmar, critical strand of U.S. foreign policy. We were among the first in the world to say that that constituted genocide, and we've been very aggressive in our foreign policy in the region. And I can't say too much because I'm helping litigate the case. But if you're interested in the South Africa case against Israel, I advise you to follow the Gambia case very closely. The rejoinder brief will be due. We'll do oral arguments in early 2026, and I promise you that this case is setting the template in mirror form. I'm on the good guy side, by the way, the Gambia side, arguing that that was genocide. But here's the point. If we allow the Myanmar regime to conflate counterterrorism and appropriate military tactics through rules of engagement and rebut genocide, that's the critical thing. So if we allow this conflation to take place, they're distinct bodies of law with distinct presumptions, and metaphorically, we've got to ensure that the court gets it right, and we don't do it by ignoring it, as Judge Brower said, or by pretending that it doesn't have salient force in the world. And on a literal shape the battlefield context, I'll give you, because I negotiated the elements of crimes. If you've ever heard of operational command, we do it every day. Every UN peacekeeping operation does it every day. Every special operations mission does it every day. Basic idea. The commander says, okay, you 12 people, you engineers, you flight people, you artillery people, you supply people, you're going to go to this place, and for a short while, you're going to report to General Hayman. And you're going to do what he tells you because he has operational control over you while you're in that space, but I still have full command. True fact, the ICC attempted to outlaw OPCON. And if they do that, it affects U.S. military operations, it affects our entire strategy, it affects NATO operations. When I say defend the battlefield, literally, that's what I mean. In Taganda, which I argued on as an Amici, they attempted to change the very definition of the word attack. Now, who knows what an attack is? Well, you know more than the ICC. Because they totally messed it up, and we fixed it on appeal. We have to be diligent to engage in those ways when it's appropriate. And the last thing here is this notion of sort of now what happens with the settlements case. Again, the cynics would say it's an advisory opinion, nobody cares. I promise you, we're already watching our diplomacy change. And if you're in the law and business space, or to be purely mercenary, if you're an Exxon investor, you should care. Because on the basis of that decision, countries around the world are beginning to reframe, sorry to sound like a law professor, but I can't help it, their erga omnes obligation, their obligation on behalf of all the other countries of the world, because the ICJ told them that they had to help stop genocide and to stop to take their part in countering, at this point, what the ICJ says is an unlawful occupation. That's a problem. Because every American company doing business in every company or licensed in every other country around the world or receiving payments through those countries will be affected by that judgment. And our diplomats have got to take that case and argue the nuances because it's a vital cross-reference. And we don't win strategically or legally by simply disengaging. We have to engage at the right time in the right way. And just the other easy example, Guyana, Venezuela. If Venezuela wins their aggression case, they eat up 70% of Guyana, which affects American interests in a major, major way, and regional interests. I'll leave you with one sort of tidbit, a foretaste, if you will, of the conversation. I wrote very long ago, in the abstract, this is a pure pinhead academic, why the ICC should never have jurisdiction over Israeli officials in occupied Gaza or the West Bank. And it's simply a matter of treaty law. The Rome Statute is a treaty like every other treaty. It was an argument based on intellectual consistency. Just here's the proper interpretation of treaty law. Here's the context of the Rome Statute. I know because I helped negotiate it. And those things don't line up. And it's a very technical, scholarly argument, kind of boring, too long, actually. But guess what? That issue is being litigated at the ICC today, right now in the pretrial chamber. And let's hope that they do the right thing and apply the law correctly in a technical matter and not just carried away by the argument, oh, it's genocide. Everybody knows it's genocide. Everybody, and get sucked into that, because that is in our interest to ensure that they apply the law with technical accuracy. And when they don't, we should be the first in the world to say so. But when they're about to do something in a way that affects our interests, and I'll close with this, with 32 seconds left, that's the first time in U.S. history that we've submitted a formal filing to the ICC on the question of jurisdiction. And I give them compliments. Anybody from the State Department here, State L? They took my argument and my argument 2.0. It's better than what I said. It's my theory, but a better framing of my theory. They're spot on right about the law. And my point is, if the court gets it right, great, they got it right. If they get it wrong, we now have a voice in the debate to say we didn't just sit passively back. We told you the correct interpretation of the law, and we can keep saying that because we believed in the institution and we believed in the rule of law. And with that, my colleague.
It is very unstable. Good afternoon, and I do thank the panelists and the Federalist Society for the opportunity to speak on this topic. This is a recurring question in American law schools. How should the United States interact with the international system when really the premise of this question is often unexplored? The international system, as we know it today, was not crafted without the heavy and extraordinary role of the United States in the structure that we have today. When we look at the International Court of Justice in 1923, Secretary of State Charles Hughes said, "Here are the reasons why the United States must be part of the predecessor court of the International Court of Justice, the Permanent Court of International Justice. First, because we are the jurisdiction that has vastly upheld international justice in the proliferation of international disputes being settled in the United States through international arbitration." He said that as far back as 1923. The second reason he gave was, if the United States does not participate in the creation and development of this international court, this will be a missed opportunity for American principles and American practices to be embedded in the international system. The third reason he gave was, if the United States participates in this mechanism, it's actually a cheaper form of dispute settlement. I kid you not. In the same letter, he quotes, "It only costs $35,000 for us to support this court." This was back in 1923. And he said, "Given the scale and proliferation of international disputes of various textures and complexions, from boundary delimitation to resource disputes to everyday cooperation with other states, this was actually a cheaper form of dispute settlement, and the United States should be there." But the last reason he gave was the most emphatic reason. And the reason is that American constitutionalism and the understanding of rights, the understanding of fundamental principles in democracy, is unique. It is unparalleled in the experience of freedom, and it is something that can be contributed to the rest of the world. Today, in 2024, the United States has limited access to the International Court of Justice because out of 80 treaties where there are compromissory clauses, not all of those are triggered before the International Court of Justice. It was the United States that pioneered the notion of consent-based jurisdiction, even dating back to that 1923 letter by Secretary of State Hughes. There would be no jurisdiction exercised by any international court over any sovereign nation without its consent. And true enough, the United States, throughout the arc of its participation in the International Court of Justice, has very forcefully and strenuously argued the limits of jurisdiction as appropriate. So one has to ask, where are the specters and where are the fears here? In the International Criminal Court, as my august colleagues have rightly pointed out, the United States is not a party to the Rome Statute to the International Criminal Court. It only participates as a member of the Security Council that can, under the terms of the statute, refer a case to the International Criminal Court for investigation. It has done so in two instances, or at least it didn't exercise a veto, against referrals involving Libya and involving Darfur. But in other circumstances, the fears that have been stoked in relation to investigations involving Afghanistan have largely also been addressed. Prosecutor Karim Khan said in 2021 that notwithstanding the ruling of the appeals chamber permitting the Office of the Prosecutor to continue its investigation into the situation in Afghanistan, his office, because of resource constraints, would only focus its investigation on the Taliban and deprioritize everything else. The United States, on its domestic front, has concluded its own domestic legislation, the American Service Members Protection Act, a slew of many other agreements and domestic laws to ensure and safeguard the capacity of its own courts to adjudicate any possible charges against its military forces or against any U.S. national. So again, I ask the question in 2024, why is it that there is trepidation and disquiet over the International Court of Justice and the International Criminal Court and the role of the United States in it? My argument here is simple. The United States has, within, since 1923, exercised not just critical, but very strategic engagement with the international system consistent with its role as a permanent member of the Security Council and as a founding member of the United Nations. It has been strategic in 25 contentious cases borne out from the record of the International Court of Justice, in 25 cases where the United States was either an applicant or a respondent. Most of the cases went the United States' favor. The United States won the Interhandel case. It got very generous delimitation under the Gulf of Maine case in that dispute with Canada. It has not always, or at least managed to neutralize what the claims were of Iran with respect to the oil platforms case. So if we look empirically at the record, what really does the United States have to fear? And most importantly, what does it have to lose? I think what the United States stands to lose by not participating and by retreating from its original commitments to the International Court of Justice and the international system are the same things that Secretary of State Hughes said in 1923. If the United States were to retreat from its active participation in the International Court of Justice, jurisprudence would be made without its imprint. And that is significant, because in an era such as 2024, when two-thirds of the world is governed by authoritarians, it would be certainly comforting, especially for small states in fledgling democracies, to know that there is an ally who is willing to stand for interpretations of international law that are consistent with democratic expectations. That's one. The second is, the United States, being the world power that it is, has numerous international dispute settlement interests. It actively uses international arbitration. It actively uses different fora. Some things just can't be negotiated, which is why in some instances the United States has submitted disputes by special agreement to the International Court of Justice. And under those circumstances, the kind of review that has been undertaken to ensure that these specific cases are decided on narrow questions consented to by the parties submitting these disputes, again, one has to wonder why there is trepidation. Perhaps there might be some trepidation with the last result in the last Iran case involving the Treaty of Amity with Iran, where Iran managed to win on some claims, the United States won on one claim. But the United States, as the democracy and the world leader that it is certainly not afraid of submitting to dispute settlement where it has not done the prior calculus of its interests. So I have worked as a law clerk at the International Court of Justice. I am also in the International Criminal Court Bar Association. I also learned international law from the New Haven School of International Law, where Myers McDougall very clearly said from the beginning, one has to know the social process and the authoritativeness of decisions as they are being made. But from where I stand, looking at the corpus of jurisprudence and the manner in which the court has exercised its jurisdiction, there does not seem to be anything to be afraid of, to be concerned of, to be worried about when the United States is not a party to a court that is going to exercise jurisdiction against its will. No dispute is pending before either of these courts that involve that kind of encroachment on jurisdiction. Rather, constant appeals are made to the United States to cooperate, especially in the execution of the arrest warrant against Mr. Putin, but also to consider that as an active leading participant in the international system, if it does not make its voice heard, others will write international law for them. And that, to me, is the biggest danger. If the United States were to retreat, were to say that we're a self-contained country, we can handle our own disputes, we can negotiate our way through everything, we will find that other countries with other understandings of democracy and the rule of law, including in my own home region in Southeast Asia, in the very same dispute on the South China Sea that I have worked on quietly for many years, will find that the rules will have changed without the active leadership and participation of the United States. I think the question before us today is less about whether or not there should be engagement or interaction by the United States, but how much more, given the demands of these times, given the proliferation of authoritarians, and the very threat to the democracy that this country modeled for the world. Thank you very much.
Professor Epstein.
Yeah. The most difficult part of my job is now beginning, getting to the podium. But thank you so much for inviting me. I think I take a very different view of the subject from what has been, and I'm going to start with something that was announced by Professor Diserta. She basically referred to 1923 and to 1945, and under those circumstances, I would have signed both the treaties she was talking about. But in 2024, the composition of the United States, its leadership under the worst possible Secretary General Guterres, has turned this thing into largely a force of evil. And if you start to look at the International Court, the United States could join it, but there are 15 other people who are going to put there. And in fact, what you're saying is you join that body and you're going to lose 14-1. And what you've done is you've legitimated the decisions of the other side by participating in those situations. The proposal that you do this on special occasions is therefore, it seems to me, much more meritorious because you participate in those cases where you think on balance you can improve the position of the United States and the rule of law. But filing dissents in cases like the ones involving Israel today
it seems to me, is absolutely the wrong thing to do, because what you do is you now legitimate an institution which has gone rogue. So you start looking at the United Nations and its enforcement mechanisms. What do you see? Well, they're going to enforce all sorts of wonderful things in Gaza. Gone. They were going to enforce the situation where Hezbollah is going to move north of the Litani River. Gone. The Israelis come in, and I think they have legitimate reasons to try to attack people, and the United Nations decides to sit in ways where they become shields in order to protect one of the adversaries. What you're doing is looking at a set of bodies which essentially has abnegated anything and is now taken over by a bunch of individuals and groups which are largely, as you said, authoritarian. And it turns out whether you participate or not, the authoritarian forces are going to be able to win out. So what does the United States do when it pulls out? It doesn't remain silent. What it tries to do in many cases is to exert as much influence as it can through various kinds of devices in order to change the situation. Now, when we start looking at this, I'll concentrate for a little bit on the contrast between China on the one hand and the Israeli situation on the other. Chinese come in. Law of sea is perfectly clear that these are open waters, and it just simply makes up islands in the middle of the thing and then says we have territorial boundaries about it. You can't think of anything that is more clownish than the arguments that they make. You could deduce it at anywhere, but the truth of the matter against somebody like the Chinese, the only language that they understand is the language of force, and either you build up your forces or they will simply roll you over. And so what happens is you could get every decree that you need, but unless the South Koreans, the Japanese, the Philippines, the Australians, and so forth, with the backing of the United States, are prepared to say you can't walk into Taiwan on the grounds that you claim that you are owning it, the international law will be worthless. And so what you have to do is to engage in that. And what's the downside? There's no particular harm to China if the sea remains open. They have become a rogue nation, and they have to be treated as such, whether they're on the Security Council or not. In the Israeli situation, I could not disagree with more with Professor Brau on the way in which he thinks it. So let's start with the question of the occupation. This is an extremely difficult issue. But of course, what happened in 1967, Israeli was attacked from without. And in fact, the question is how you defend yourself. Gaza was under essentially Egyptian rule, and before that happened, and the Israelis went in there in order to stem further violence. You then have this international arrangement saying it's an occupied country. But what the professor did not say is, what is the situation? They did not occupy Palestine. They occupied Jordan. And the question is whether the Jordanians want to take it back. And if they don't want to take it back, there's nothing which says that the indigenous Palestinians own the place when, in terms of international law, they were not a nation, they were not a state. So what happens is you get these long negotiations. And by 1998, the Israelis tried to work out a deal in which they would create a combination state of some sort on the West Bank and in Gaza. And Mr. Arafat just dawdled and walked away from the entire thing. So the question is, when you see all of that behavior, why do you start to say that the occupied territory is still occupied, instead of recognizing the much more complicated situation that has developed and which requires a very different kind of response? I do not defend everything that the Israelis do. Like everybody else, I have been troubled by some of the occupation of building up permanent settlements. But on the other hand, I will say quite confidently, if what you did is you pulled out of that area and turned it over to Palestinian Authority, the state of Israel would be gone. What would happen is they would bring in all sorts of forces from the Arab world, mask their situation, and essentially overwhelm Israel. And so the idea that somehow or other you're going to try to create an individual nation is not true. Some people like Thomas Friedman have started to talk about a demilitarized situation in this new company. Well, that was what was supposed to happen in Gaza. And at first, when Hamas won, it just simply threw the opposition over the wall and then has built all of these territorial treaties and so forth. We hear about the South African charges. Well, they were drafted by Hamas and given to somebody. And somehow or other, when you look at the situation in the International Court of Justice, I mean, it's hard to read it with a straight face. They said, you know, you're supposed to turn those hostages back. Naughty, naughty. Is anyone prepared to put any force behind that? Is the United States prepared to even use force to recover its own national hostages? Everybody who was killed in that promiscuous slaughter were not just Israelis. There were people from many other kinds of nations. And what's happened is nobody but nobody is prepared to do anything than to say it's a bargaining chip, as opposed to say it's a moral outrage. So why would anyone want to put confidence in a body which essentially takes clear violations and ignores their violation? Then they invent charges against Israel for genocide. Well, let's start with two things. One, the end. Mr. Netanyahu's relied. If we had the policies that he's favoring, you'd end the war against the Nazis. If you have the policy that's favored by the current UN, what you do is you try to work some accommodation which allow Nazi Germany to survive and Hamas to survive in some kind of a governance relationship. God knows what it would be, because it will simply bring back, there's no effort whatsoever on their part to repudiate their charter. There's no reason whatsoever to give them the light of day. Removing them is an absolute moral imperative. And then the question is, well, how do you create a state? The UN is an utterly worthless, completely contemptible organization which will not do anything because it's never done anything before. And so the only way you can do this, in my judgment, is to have a situation in which the Israelis control the military, local people control the peace. What you try to do is to encourage contracts and negotiations and commerce within that zone and across the zone. And people ought to remember that on October 6th, there was a ceasefire in place. On October 6th, the Israelis had a large number of workers coming in from the Gaza Strip to do in Israel. On October 6th, the Israelis' hospitals took care of Palestinian children. And on October 7th, there was a peace rally at Nova, which was met by brutal force. And then what you try to say is, well, what about the genocide charges? Well, if you're going to make a genocide charge against the Israelis, you have to make it against everybody in the entire history of the world which has had to deal with a guerrilla movement. The United States, when it took after ISIS, the best estimate of casualties was 9 civilians for every military person who was involved. The Israeli situation, if you take independent expertise by John Spencer and so forth, the number is really very different. It's less than 1-to-1. What happens is the Palestinian Health Commission puts out numbers which aggregate. They ignore the differences, rather, between military people and civilian people. They don't talk about people who were killed by their own fire. They don't talk about people who were killed and executed by Hamas for dereliction. They don't talk about human shields and all the rest of that stuff. So it turns out that what you have here is a totally indefensible kind of situation. And the only thing you have to do with that is you cannot join in as a minority, get wiped out on this, and give legitimacy to a regime which has no legitimacy and deserves no legitimacy. And so I think if Charles Evans Hughes were writing today in 2024, every single one of the preconditions that he thought was satisfied under international law at that time are now violated. The composition of the United Nations is completely changed. Every time an Israeli ambassador speaks, everybody else walks out of the chamber. And it turns out when they start to speak, a death to Israel is a perfectly common remark. You cannot join in an enterprise like that. What would you do, for example, with the relief agency? Well, the answer is you don't give it a dime if some of its members are part of Hamas and are engaged in attack. You find some other way in which to engage in civilian assistance rather than relying on these kinds of organizations. So over and over again, what has happened is the international order has collapsed, and if the Americans join in its collapse, they legitimate all the terrible things that have happened. So what do you have to do? Get yourself a new Secretary of General. Get yourself a new location. As far as I'm concerned, the only reason why the UN is in New York is because of the restaurants. Find some place to put it where they're going to have to do some genuine deprivation. Change the budget so it's not funded by the United States. Eliminate all of these various agencies. You have to be extremely tough. If, in fact, what you do is basically in the next Trump administration is keep the status quo ante, the situation will only degenerate. So I welcome Ms. Elise Stefanik, because she actually calls this thing out. And if you get people saying, I don't know what the definition of genocide is, and then you apply that to the Israelis, who've done more than any other nation in the history of the world to avoid collateral damage, and ignore that definition with respect to Hamas, which had no military targets whatsoever, You are living in a parallel universe that is immoral and indefensible. And so what the United States should do is tough love. You have to kill off the criminal court on these key cases, and you have to tell the ICJ that it's not going to be able to operate with our support or with our consent so long as it makes these decisions, which I regard, particularly the most recent one, as simply antithetical to every principle of peace and justice. It is one of the most disgraceful documents that has ever been written, and I do not see how anybody can endorse an organization that is allowed by 15 votes to one abstention or partial thing, and the Israeli dissenter to operate in the justice. So I think what happens is the international law order, just to end on this situation, we have to start over. And if we don't do it quickly, and if we don't do it through some sensible activities by the Trump administration, a very big if, as we all know, it's never going to happen, and the world will continue to descend into a slow slide. International law in the 19th century was a recognized, organized, civilized body of law. What's happened now through the centralized control is it's become a degenerate mess, and I think we have to fix that right now. Thank you.
Thank you, Professor Epstein. Let's go down the table and give everyone a chance to respond to previous comments, and then I'll ask some follow-up questions. Judge Brower.
I think I've already said it.
And nothing you want to add. All right. Yes, Professor Newton.
Well, I just want to clarify sort of big picture, and I think most people realize this, but let's be clear. The ICC is a treaty body created, and it is entirely based on the consent of states, both territorial jurisdiction and substantive jurisdiction and nationality-based jurisdiction. And for its most hardcore supporters, of course, they say, well, it's about genocide. It's about the most serious crimes of concern to the world. And they then attempted to turn it into a universal jurisdiction court, which is the core of the emotional, philosophical debate underneath it. And if you want to talk about it, this is called the principle of admissibility. And it's designed from the ground up, and I mean this, to be the court of last resort, the court that only works when the domestic systems are failing. And what the court has done over its jurisprudence is flip that on its head to say, essentially, we can take jurisdiction when we want to take jurisdiction on the grounds that we want to take jurisdiction, and more importantly, over the precise crimes that we want to take jurisdiction. U.S. did a lengthy investigation into Judge Brower and decided that he didn't commit the things and that prosecution wasn't warranted. That's all wonderful. We're going to do something else because we still want to prosecute Judge Brower. That's what it's turned into. In fact, when you really understand the jurisprudence, and it's a long ways. So with respect to my friend, that's why the United States can't join the court. Until they actually create a court that's based on the model that it was created, it's a form of injustice to say, right, we've watched this, and now it's all okay. We sort of give, we're going to start from scratch now. I think it's too late for that.
Just say something about the statute, because it's widely known that the crime of aggression is not included in it, which was why the ICC had to issue its warrant for the arrest of Vladimir Putin on the basis of having taken children from Ukraine into Russia, which is unlawful, and a secondary person in that government who was in charge of that program was included in the arrest warrant. Well, why wasn't, after the Second World War, doing something like this, why was aggression not in it? It's mentioned as a possibility. It could be introduced into the statute with, according to a procedure set forth in the 63-page Statute of Rome. But because of what's happened in Ukraine, there started in England an effort to establish a separate international tribunal to deal with the form of aggression. Now, how responsible was the United States for the fact that aggression didn't go into the Rome Statute? I was not involved in the negotiations, but I've always strongly suspected, because of what had gone on in Iran, in Afghanistan and so forth, maybe even the United States wasn't keen about having aggression as a crime within the jurisdiction. I just point this out as it's not just the Finnish institution, but it's how the institution was established. In this case, with a lot of safeguards within the 63-page Rome Statute. But I just picked this out as maybe an example of how it was carefully negotiated by the people most involved.
Okay. Professor Desierto.
I understand a lot of Professor Epstein's general unhappiness with the United Nations, but the political organs of the United Nations are entirely distinct from the judicial settlement processes and the independence of the court, of the International Court of Justice, which was created as the principal judicial organ of the United Nations. The thing we have to be clear about is that the actual underlying dispute between Israel and its neighbors is not before the court. It is not before the court. The 2024 advisory opinion issued by the court, much like the 2004 advisory opinion on the wall, could be arrived at and decided by the judges on that front, what the legal consequences are of those specific actions, without attributing international liability, which is an entirely different matter from pronouncing that there is a breach. International liability means that not only is there a breach and it is attributable to a state, but that none of your defenses are operative, and therefore you are indeed liable, and thus the enforcement procedures kick in. They will never kick in for an advisory opinion, which by its very nature is non-binding, recommendatory, and at best can, as a judicial decision, try to crystallize into customary international law. Now, this is why I have a difference with Professor Epstein, because where there's a discomfort with the United States dissent in these cases, it is those precise dissents that prevent customary international law from crystallizing against the interests of the State of Israel, which has never been able to adjudicate or litigate its claims before international dispute settlement. So whatever sort of conflation we may have about the political nature of the UN, and granted there are so many flaws within the UN system, insofar as the court is concerned, what you saw come out in July 19, 2024 is a non-binding advisory opinion which has never heard the actual legal defenses and the actual evidence of the State of Israel, and for that reason cannot be taken as the definitive international law on the subject. Is it now being used as a rallying cry by opponents of Israel? Absolutely. But it is also precisely for that reason that the United States cannot abandon the field. Otherwise, the other source of international law, customary international law, will start crystallizing against the very same interests that the United States is trying to protect. I mean, I'm empathetic with a lot of the views that have been discussed here today, but I do want to make that fine distinction.
Yeah, look, that's the mistake, the distinction that Professor Newton basically disparaged when he said, you may think about this solely in terms of enforceability, but I think about it in terms of the collateral consequences that could have, both with public opinion and with other kinds of adjudication taking place anywhere. And so the point is, why did they issue such a ghastly opinion like this? The first thing to note about it is there was not a single shred of evidence of any sort that they bothered to review. They just treated this as though it was a judgment on the pleadings without any statement of fact. The moment it gets out there, everybody treats it in exactly the opposite way, as though it's a preliminary finding against the Israelis, and that is, in effect, you do not want to do anything of that sort. If you want to say something, all right, just simply say, we have a jurisdictional issue here, but what they did and essentially said was the allegations that were made were presumptively evidence of genocide. There's no other way to read this thing. And the one thing on which they did give a final judgment, which was the question of the illegality of the capture, nobody anywhere in the world has taken the slightest bit.
So what's really going on in this particular situation is you have to make a second best judgment on strategic behavior. Do you stay with an utterly derelict institution in its current form, or do you strike out independently? And there is a high cost to leaving this community, she says. But I'm going to say one thing about this, the meaning of the word crystallize, which I think we have deeper sense about it. When you have a customary system of international law, what it does is it works by incremental judgments here, there, and the other place. And if you start going back, for example, to reading the accounts of international law in connections with the insular cases, I think mostly the Kabatabana and so forth, what they do is they talk about how jurisprudence slowly accrete one thing over another, and that after a time what you do is you have a common law process. You start talking about crystallization in terms of an absolutely rigged and totally incompetent body, that is not incrementalism, that is crystallization by diktat, and it turns out it's not to be trusted because what is going on is bad. So my response is, if they wrote opinions like the one they've written, when it comes to anything, if they run a trial, it's going to be exactly the same kind of situation, and you would be absolutely out of your mind to do it, because remember, my response to earlier comments, right, is that when you start to put this thing out there in the way in which you make these findings of illegal occupation and so forth, and you start putting the remedies that you want into place, you're talking about the slow extinction of Israel. So what happens is, suppose we create, I'm going to ask you, what does everybody think about the following proposal, all right? What we do is we decide to recognize a Palestinian state. Is it going to be militarized or not? If it's going to not be militarized, how are you going to enforce it? And when the moment that breaks down, the state of Israel is dead, if in fact you can send Iranian troops into this particular location given their national sovereignty, lean on Israel, and kill it. That's the question you have to ask. There is no way, in my judgment, you can keep this in a demilitarized way. Essentially, it's either everything or nothing, and by far the correct response is very simple, return to the status quo ante of October 6th, with one exception, no Hamas.
Professor Newton, I think, wanted to.
I hate to sound like a dang lawyer, but I think I'm on fairly safe ground. I do want to make clear, as just as sort of a technical matter, and this is a two-finger, so I won't take the time to explain it or to give you all the details why, but I don't want you to think, I think it's incorrect for us as experts to think about the ICJ advisory opinion and the International Criminal Court occupation case in distinct bubbles, Venn diagrams. And here's just the basic track record if you want to go back and look at it. Article 49 of the Fourth Geneva Convention makes it a crime to forcibly transfer people. The Palestinians were very successful in their diplomacy through the years. And what they did, if you look at Article 828B8 of the Rome Statute, it says it's a crime, it's a war crime, to directly or indirectly. Those words were added in the Rome Statute for the explicit diplomatic purposes from the Palestinian, and really the Arab League, of reframing the debate against the Israelis. Okay, ancient history, that's 1998 when they agreed to the statute. But now you come full circle, because that indirect argument is absolutely buttressed in those filings at the ICC on that matter by the ICJ advisory opinion. And that's the danger, is this, on different facts and on different law and on different theories, the sort of the migration in a macro way without the granular detail that's needed to really get the law correct and precise.
All right. So maybe I can ask some follow-up questions. One of them is, Professor Newton adverted to, you know, this being consent-based jurisdiction here. And, you know, the Heritage Foundation has put out a report, you know, concerns about what happens if the U.S. accedes to the treaty and grants jurisdiction. Is there a sovereignty problem with saying suddenly the ICC can try U.S. citizens, you know, perhaps for crimes committed on U.S. soil? What are the limits or the safeguards that give us confidence that this won't be abused? I mean, we see that China and Russia don't seem to have opted into compulsory jurisdiction as great powers. They don't feel a need to. They have more to lose than to gain. Is the calculus different for the U.S., or are there safeguards or assurances that I haven't mentioned?
Well, I think it's different because I think, unfortunately, if you look around with the Russians, the Chinese, and the Iranians and so forth, they have a large number of people who support them. You look around in the United States and you have a few Western democracies which are still standing tight. But even if you start to take the position of the Prime Minister of Great Britain and the waffling position of the Germans and the French, the number of people who are strong and stout allies of the Israelis or the Americans on any of these things is now reduced to an inexcusable handful. Under those circumstances, if the Russians are going to stay out and they have all the backing, smart committee will move it. We go in without any backing, it will be essentially a very dangerous kind of annihilation type situation. The world is hanging by a thread. And why is that? Well, start with Afghanistan. We had a successful withdrawal, I am told by a former president of the United States, but it was a catastrophe. A couple months later, Mr. Putin looks there and he says, they're not going to do anything in Ukraine. The Chinese are starting to flex their muscles. The Iranians and the Houthis are doing their stuff. So what we have is a world in which it turns out when you don't have a cat, the mice will play. And I'm a strong believer in the old principle of Pax Americana, in which the United States has to take a dominant military role in order to bring people under it. My fear is that Trump does not understand that. My fear is that the libertarians never understand that. The question is how you can become a realist without trying to become an imperialist. It's a hard thing to do, but if you don't understand that you have to play that role, what you're going to see is that power will be forfeited, decentralization will start to take place, and your enemies will start to strut across the wall knowing that there's no sanction that they're going to have to face. That's the world that we face with the UN, useless body, dangerous body. It's the world we face with both of these courts, particularly the Court of Criminal Justice. It's a basically, as far as I'm concerned, a rogue institution, and nobody should participate in it. And in fact, the consent basis is one that you have to keep. The idea that universal consent by everybody else counts as consent by you as an individual nation is no better in international law than it turns out if 10 people say, well, we now have a contract, and you're the 11th guy, and you decided not to join. A 10-to-1 vote, we win. You can't basically convert a situation where individual consent is required to having a regime in which a majority or a supermajority can impose its will on the dissent.
Professor Newton, did you want to?
Yeah, I'm going to tell you all a dirty little secret. So notwithstanding the fact that we're recording this, and there are a bunch of you listening, you know, the U.S. diplomats get beaten up around the world for American exceptionalism and American hypocrisy. And, you know, this is, for example, one of the critical factors in nation states that refuse to help us enforce sanctions against Russia. We get beaten up about that all over the world. The fact is that the ICC, and I'm in the negotiations, so I can tell you this firsthand, was created on much the same flawed premise. I can't tell you the times I've heard people saying, what does the United States have to worry about? You have a credible justice system. You enforce the law. You investigate. This court won't come after you. After all, it's a court of last resort. And they would say, this court is created for the Saddam Husseins of the world. French diplomat one time came up to me, and she did the hair toss, and she said, oh, Michael, don't be naive. No Frenchman will ever stand before this court. The fact is that the court, and the question was about why is America different? If you really look at the treaty carefully, the diplomats recognize that, and they embedded some things that do recognize the differences in America, given the fact that we do keep the peace and have kept the peace and have people in 100-plus countries around the world. Article 98 is one easy example. Article 27 is another example. Article 12, the very structure of Article 12, the structure of Article 17. There's a lot of those examples at very granular levels, and I don't know how to say it politely. That was then, this is now. When I teach this, I call it second and third and fourth generation lawmaking. The court has been involved in 20-plus years of reinterpretation and expansion and institutional interests, so that today the recognition of American exceptionalism and why we're different has largely been erased from the statute in ways that harm us. And if you don't believe me, look around the world and ask yourself, has anybody in the world said, oh, by the way, the Israelis really do have a pretty well-functioning justice system? I mean, after all, people can take cases with no standing concerns straight to the Israeli Supreme Court sitting as the High Court of Justice. The Israeli High Court of Justice has looked at rules of engagement cases, which would never happen in our context, of course, because of standing and non-justiciability and political question. We have all kinds of ways. They do that in Israel. I haven't heard a single voice in the ICC debates making that very basic point. And it goes back to the notion that this court was created to fill gaps. And I'll be honest, there's enough war criminals to go around. There's enough genocidaires to go around. If the ICC can take a couple of those players off the board while the rest of the world does its job, great. I'm all for it.
But I'm going to make
in a technical legal way. The problem is it gets very political.
If you look at the situation, the Israeli jurisprudential system is an internal wreck and a mess. And the Netanyahu reforms may not have been perfect, but there were vast improvements of everything that went over. But if you're asking the question, is there judicial oversight over the activities of your own military forces, given the extraordinary powers of the Israeli Supreme Court, which it can exercise directly or through some other mechanism, Israel is, in fact, the most regulated country in the world on that particular point, and yet it's now treated as though it's a government which simply gives its military a free hand. What has happened is all of these debates have been put to one side because everybody who was on the side of judicial protest had planned a great meeting for October 10th, right, on October 5th, and then October 7th comes, and all of a sudden what you realized was that your efforts to reform the court was such a distraction that guys like Sinwar thought it gave you an opportunity to take advantage of the divisive activities on the Israeli side in order to gain support. And so I have worked on those judicial reforms extensively, trying to limit it to those reforms and to make it very clear that this is not an argument in favor of an annexation of the West Bank. In fact, I would regard that as an unmitigated disaster and am strongly opposed to it. But what you really have to understand when you start looking in that situation is that the Israelis got themselves suckered in a whole variety of ways, and then by the time you got to October 8th, the entire policy shifted from exotic issues of how you support Supreme Court justices to the situation, how do we make sure that we don't die as a nation? And I think the idea that somehow or other Israeli is a rogue nation for which the International Court of Justice has to intervene is, in fact, itself a gross miscarriage of justice.
All right. Yes.
My very brief response to this is one thing we also have to remember is that it is now November 2024, and the International Criminal Court's pretrial chamber has not granted any arrest warrant application of the Office of the Prosecutor. In fact, it is conducting an external investigation of the prosecutor himself in relation to other allegations being brought against him. So I understand much of the debate on what constitutes genocide or who pronounces it. In this instance, nobody is pronouncing it in the international courts.
Look, this
there's no pronouncement yet. And I understand that there are fears that this might come out. Look, but in the instance where there is nothing, no pronouncement by a court that genocide exists, neither the International Court of Justice nor the actual International Criminal Court, I'm sort of loath to give so much weight to how public opinion digests judicial opinions.
I think that's completely wrong. What you needed was a repudiation of what would happen rather than silence, which means that opportunistically it may or may not be done. This is like saying, well, we don't have to worry about any of the assaults inside the American system. After all, Judge Marshall has yet to hand down his sentence against Donald Trump. Right? That's no comfort. The whole point is that the proceedings were illegitimate to begin with, and the residual uncertainty is completely unacceptable under these cases. And so unless they completely back off, as far as I'm concerned, this just could be a waiting game to be sprung at the optimal moment, and I don't want to take those kinds of risks when you have a body which has launched a bomb and says, don't you worry, we have it sitting out there, and we have a match in hand, but we haven't lit the fuse. This is not sufficient, as far as I'm concerned, to return ourselves to the international order that we need and must respect.
Hi, let's go to some questions from the floor. Could you introduce yourself and where you're from before you ask a question? I ask that the questions be no more than three sentences and they, in fact, end with a question mark.
That's good. So my name is Andrei Kostyuk. I'm from Ukraine. Law and Liberty Circle, Ukraine, Ukrainian Catholic University. So naturally, my question is about Ukrainian situation. First sentence. There is unprovoked invasion, and we claim that this invasion has a clear aim of abolishing Ukrainian statehood, abolishing Ukrainian nation, prohibiting us to speak our language, and as a result, we think it's a genocidal intention. So it's first sentence. The second sentence, during the unprovoked military aggression, there was a very well documented list of war crimes, starting from kidnapping kids with the clear intention to change their identity. They have parents, but they are nevertheless adopted by Russians. Tortures of civilians. Dozens of thousands of Ukrainian women are raped, according to UN.
What's the question?
Tortures of Ukrainian prisoners of war, etc. Now I'm come to the third sentence, to the question. Should there be any international trial, even after the peace compromise or whatever it will be after the war? Because in our opinion, it's not only about our pain and injustice committed to our nation, but it's really about the essence of international order, because this is done in online in the 21st century. Billions of people are able to see it now in the internet. So how you think international community, including the United States as leading power in the world, shall react judicially to this situation which is now in Ukraine? I'm finished.
All right. What, if any, kind of judicial reaction should there be after the end of the war?
Okay. I have an answer to that question. The consent stuff will apply. Putin will not yield. What you should do is not wait to the end of the war, but you should reverse every single policy of the Biden administration, encourage the export of natural gas to crash their markets, make sure that you disrupt the arrangements with the Iranians so they don't have free cash and weapons to go anywhere else. On this thing, essentially freeze assets to the extent that you can do so anywhere, and to make sure that American military force can be directed against anything that takes place in Russia, which is used as a base of operations against the Ukraine. The judicial stuff is, as we say in Churchillian language, too little too late. And what you want to do is to start now, and if you want to talk about somebody who's a true disaster, the former or the current president has always essentially thought that what you do is you can have a modulated, graduated response. The net effect of that has been as follows. It lengthens the war, puts greater internal strains on the Ukrainian, weakens their position in a bargaining, because the president thinks that de-escalation will result in compromise. There has never been a more mindless theory put forward by a more mindless man than Joseph Biden.
Right, let's hear from the other panelists. What, if anything, can happen given that Russia has not consented to jurisdiction in international tribunals?
Well, there maybe you don't know, there are a lot of efforts going on. The Council of Europe has established a registry of claims against Russia, obviously financial claims for everything that has been lost. The government of Ukraine has been hard at work also assembling facts about the war crimes. The whole problem has been there's no problem in setting up at least a claim situation. A lot have been people working on that. The question, of course, is how to get paid for it. Now, you may know that the frozen Soviet or Russian funds in the United States and in Europe are now basically being made available to Ukraine. It's billions of dollars. The thought was that would be saved to pay claims, but the situation on the ground has gotten so serious that it's now being used for actually by Ukraine to weaponize as much as possible and put it into the war effort. So there's a lot been going on, except for the proposal to establish a new international tribunal to try Putin on the aggressive war claim. I don't know where that stands now. I haven't seen it yet a lot, but there's been a lot of action going on in the General's Assembly and in the Council in Europe and between a lot of friends of mine who have been asked by Ukraine to help them out.
Does either of you want to?
Yeah, because I've been doing this. I hate to see us do. I always have to smile when journalists say, oh, well, you know, we've never prosecuted these things during a war, during an ongoing set of hostilities. And I'm like, you hadn't been in Iraq. Like, we were chasing evidence all over Iraq in the middle of a hot insurgency. And the answer is, I hate to see us do in Ukraine what the United Nations did in Iraq, which was to spend $160 million for not a single result because they put their own institutional interests in the UNITAD context above the interests of the Iraqi people and above the interest in sovereign pursuit of justice. I've been on the ground. I've been helping Ukrainian judges. The School of Judges has set up what's called a consultative council, which is a way for a trial judge on the ground to ask a simple question about simple evidence and get international experts to tell them, this is the law. Now, judge, you go find the facts, but here's the law against which to apply those facts. There's a lot more work to be done, and it's going way too slow, in part because we can't get out where we need to be to reinforce the people that need to be reinforced. And in a perfect world, you know, we have medicine sans frontier, we would have lawyers sans frontier that can surge, and technical experts that can get on the ground. It's just not going fast enough, and we're wasting a whole lot of money. And I could tell you more stories, except it's painful.
All right. We'll take this, and then we'll go on from there.
My short answer is that when the Philippines won the South China Sea arbitration overwhelmingly against China, against China's consent to its jurisdiction, and won it back in 2016, very few countries actually knew the nine-dash line map. Very few countries were even interested in the massive island reclamation and the ongoing atrocities that were being committed in the region. International law, through the creation of that decision, that contentious case that has a binding effect on China, has been used as leverage within the region, not just by the Philippines, but by other actors within the region. The hard work of doing that, which Ukraine has to do, is precisely to enlist the international community to apply what is called proportional countermeasures for what are open breaches of international law. You don't see that a lot yet from the rest of the world, largely because there's a hesitation over finding whether or not there is international legality or illegality in this situation. But I fairly expect that if there is a categorical finding that of Russia's series of violations of international law, the core violation of Article 2, Paragraph 4, very few countries would turn aside from its third state obligations not to recognize illegal situations. We just don't have that yet right now.
Okay. Over here. Next question.
So I think my question was just answered, so I'm just going to note to Professor Epstein that Professor John Yu is only just downstairs, and we've not seen a new episode of Law Talk in quite some time.
Okay.
All right.
And the three people that laughed, those are the subscribers to that podcast.
All right. Next question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Joseph Morris. I practice in Chicago and in London. And I'm going to follow the Kostiuk paradigm, Your Honor. Sentence one. I notice in the real world that when people seek actual judicial relief against international malefactors, whether it's the financiers of terrorism or it's Argentine sovereign debtors, they tend to do it in the domestic courts of the United States, whether they're Article III courts or state courts. Sentence two. I take note that the second section of Article 6 makes treaties part of the supreme law of the land. Now my question, which will end in a question mark, do we need to worry that if we adhere to these treaty regimes with their corrupt materials, notwithstanding the occasional felicitous decision that emerges from them, that we tend to infect our entire system of domestic law with this corrupt system of treaty law, which would then become part of the supreme law of our domestic regime.
It's a risk, yeah. Thank you, Joe. I'll give you a dime.
All right.
Oh, that's a joke that goes back 50 years.
Responses from the other members of the panel.
Well, I'm not sure I've entirely understood. If you're talking about the International Criminal Court, the whole thing is basically set up for states actually to prosecute people in their own jurisdiction who are alleged to have offended international law. I mean, there's just stacks and stacks of rules and a lot of protections basically for states. If a state will prosecute, then you don't have to worry about the International Criminal Court. And if the states will not prosecute, then you've got a problem. But there are also different rules for states' parties to the statute and different rules for states that are not parties to the statute as to how to proceed. But the emphasis is on you guys do it yourself when there's a real problem. We don't need to intervene.
Let me put a fine point on that. If you look at the Rome Statute, what you'll see is a lot of treaties. I forget where Tom went. I didn't see him. He disappeared. You'll see a lot of treaties that we've already given advice and consent to. The Genocide Convention is perfectly reflected in the Great Breach Provisions. But you'll also see a whole range of sui generis crimes. So adopting the Rome Statute and embedding it into U.S. law through the vehicle of the Rome Statute process would obviate, for example, our failure to ratify Protocol 1, even though, as my colleague would say, we do accept many of those provisions as custom. The point is, it would be revolutionary, and we are not equipped to do that adequately. Not least of which, of course, are the crimes against humanity provisions. Now, would this be a problem in the real world? An American who committed crimes against humanity, I have no doubt, would be prosecuted in an Article III court. And the ICC would come along and say, but we get the authority to say that it has to be the same person for the same conduct. And again, that's second-generation lawmaking. They're subsuming that authority to themselves. So that would be the problem. It would be the transfer of that authority from sitting judges, in our context, to other judges with treaty-based authority to supersede our judgments.
Look, there is another question. The Alien Tort Act gives us extraordinary jurisdiction over various kinds of activities that take place overseas, and I frankly don't understand whether or not this is going to help or hinder the way in which we try to resolve these questions. But it certainly means that the United States is going to exert its jurisdiction whether or not it remains a party to the international courts.
We've got 4 minutes left. My hope is we can get through two more questions. And so the way to do this is I'm going to stack up. We'll take both of them at the same time and then let the panel respond to both, either sure. or both issues. The first sure. one here, and then immediately before the panel answers, second one here.
Okay, Sam McVeigh. I'm a retired Marine judge advocate. Question. First, thank you, Richard, for injecting the real world into this discussion. And secondly, are we more concerned about the ICC than the ICJ, since that could affect our sons and daughters who are in combat?
All right. And second question.
So my question is, to what extent do you think the United States can change the sort of post-1945 paradigm of viewing all international law and all human rights violations through the lens of the Holocaust, which I'm a descendant of Holocaust survivors, where it was a mass extermination against people who were not violent, had no jurisdiction, had no political ambitions to create a state within Europe, and did not have any militant activities. They were just a different race, a different culture, a different religion, and now the situation is being adopted to defend militants with terroristic and genocidal ambitions against others under the shield of human rights, specifically, I mean, Hamas. So how can the United States engage to change that very narrow but somewhat correct post-1945 paradigm to reflect dealing with terrorists, savages, other genociders, et cetera?
All right. I'll let panelists respond to either or both as they like.
Well, this one here was basically, as I understand, well, what about our boys and girls who are in combat? They are obliged not to commit war crimes. That's in the law that governs them here. And ever since Nuremberg and the trial of the Nazi leaders that were still alive, It is, and that's what is, you read this in the paper every day now since Trump was elected, and the concern at the Pentagon, what if we're asked to do something which we know is unlawful, and we could be tried for that one place or another. So it's, we assume, we operate on the assumption that our troops act lawfully, and there have been cases in the past that we're aware of where they were found by military tribunals not to have acted lawfully and have been then penalized as a result. So
but
our
the point
troops
here
have
is
to operate in
this
under
is all done
what
domestically.
Is accepted as their code of conduct.
This is all done domestically by a military justice system which has extraordinary protection. And when I have taught, actually teach that course from time to time, the great achievement of the American system is it takes a top-down command and control economy, i.e. the military, and manages to make enough adjustments from the civil system, where you have separation of powers, to be reasonably credible on the question of discipline against American soldiers who misbehave. And that's an argument for saying if you take care of your own knitting, you don't want an international tribunal with all sorts of collateral motives to interfere and to wreck the whole system.
Any last comment?
I would actually push that further. It's not that you don't want it. It's that that intervention is illegitimate and contrary to the treaty. That is not what Article 17 right. says. But let's be honest. Where's my Marine friend?
Good. That's all great.
We
I
have
wish
to,
I knew
no,
about
serious.
Article 17, but you're right.
I think it's up to us to ensure with integrity and fidelity to the law that our system, in fact, does work. It's easy to puff our chest and say, well, we're Americans. We prosecute our own.
We have reached 4:30, and we will adjourn after one last announcement. If you are seeking CLE, this is the last panel of the day, please be sure to check out by scanning the QR code you scanned when you checked in. Thank you all to the panelists and the audience. We are adjourned.
Nice to meet you. Take care.
Yes, that's right.
Well, we have our disagreements, but we keep it amiable.
No, she...